So this morning we begin our investigation of the third section of Bodhidharma's instructions. And I'll just read it again. Beneficial action is skillfully to benefit all classes of sentient beings. That is, to care about their distant and near future, and to help them by using skillful means. In ancient times, someone helped a caged tortoise. Another took care of an injured sparrow. They did not expect a reward. They were moved to do so only for the sake of beneficial action. Foolish people think that if they help others first, their own benefit will be lost, but this is not so. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. To greet practitioners, a lord of old three times stopped in the middle of his bath and arranged his hair, and three times left his dinner table. He did this solely with the intention of benefiting others. He did not mind instructing even subjects of other lords. Thus, you should benefit friend and enemy equally. You should benefit self and others alike. If you have this mind, even beneficial action for the sake of grasses, trees, wind, and water is spontaneous and unremitting. This being so, make a wholehearted effort to help the ignorant. So I'm not going to talk about them today, but just to mention that Dogen is referring to three different Chinese folk tales in this text. So it might seem like helping a caged tortoise and helping an injured sparrow and rearranging your hair don't make too much sense, but they all are references to instances where people saw a need. In one case, helped a tortoise, in another case, helped an injured sparrow. In another case, kept leaving his own bath and his own dinner table to tend to the needs of others. All stories that were familiar folk tales or parts of the historical record at the time. But what I want to talk about today is the core of this section, which I believe is right in the middle of it. And interestingly, we're right in the middle of it. We're right in the middle of our Anga. And for those of us in residence, for those of us coming and going, for those of us who are listening to the recordings, perhaps you can feel the tender heart of your own humanness opening more and more to Dogen's message. It's such a deep and profound teaching, and also a kind and a broad teaching. So right in the middle of this text, he says, beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. So it's important to know that this is not just a guideline for the right way to behave. This is not an instruction manual to be good doobies. It's not about right and wrong and being nice. In fact, as we've said again and again, Dogen is very careful to differentiate between being kind, being generous, and currying favor, which is the kind of helpfulness which comes with an intentionality that might be directed towards the self. That is an intentionality where we think, I will do good and I will do this for these people and then I will get benefit. And he's very clear in this section that true beneficial action is always about seeing through the delusion of separateness of self and other. So he says towards the end of the whole text that all four of these ways of being a bodhisattva in a sense compound each other, that they're all contained within each other. So there are really 16 ways of acting like a bodhisattva, being a bodhisattva in activity. So at this point in our investigation, we can perhaps begin to see that giving, True generosity, where we see through the delusion of self and other and realize that giver and receiver are the same. Kind speech, where we speak in a way that recognizes the identity of self and other. And now here in beneficial action, where we recognize that everything we do, everything we say, everything we give, everything we receive, is in a sense a play of recognition of this undivided connection. Every single one of us in complete connection with everyone else. When not benefiting is occurring, that's only because separation is occurring. In the biggest view of all, of course, benefaction is happening all the time. There is always benefit, always this connection, whether we're conscious of it or not. And so our job, of course, as people of the way, as practitioners of Zen, is to not only do this unconsciously, but to recognize that we're doing it, and to feel this non-separation, this complete connection. I was thinking today about how subtle this can be, because, of course, the mind gets so much in the way of everything that we do and say and think. That is the discursive mind, the mind that makes this and that, black and white, good and bad, you and me. It's so used to being in charge that it's almost always attempting its subtle or sometimes not so subtle defensiveness of itself. And in this defensiveness of the self, the tender heart of the bodhisattva can be apparently harmed. Dogen says in the text that Steve read, had us read today, in the Fukensa Zengi, the universally recommended instruction for Zazen, if a trace of disagreement arises, the mind is lost in confusion. He's not telling us, don't be confused, don't disagree. But he is instructing us to see through disagreement, to see that when the little self feels harmed, then the little self yearns to protect itself. This is how it is for us human beings. It's natural. It's not something we can prevent or stop. It's just the way we are. All of us are like this. We feel cut off. We feel that our view is not being heard. We feel that our experience is not being recognized. And we yearn so much for this imaginary, separate someone else to affirm for us. But what we forget is that the affirming is happening all the time. There is never a time when the affirming isn't happening. And so we contract. We all do it, and then we strike out. I think so much, and how can we help it, of the situation in Boston. And I think of the stories that I've heard of the bombers and the stories that I've heard of the helpers, the organizers of the event. We talked to our daughter the other night, who said that on the news they were reporting, and also she had some people she knew who were close to the scene, and that the reports were of the amazing capacity of the organizers of the marathon, not people who were trained in conflict resolution or keeping people from panicking or crowd control, maybe a little crowd control, but that somehow or other they were able to rise up and turn around and calm the panicking crowds. This is an example of this beneficial action. This is an example of this capacity in the moment of need to come forward without selfishness, to actually come forward and to not think, I have an idea, bombs are going off and people are panicking, would be really good if I tried to calm the crowd. I'm pretty sure that there wasn't enough time to have that string of thoughts, but I don't know. But this instant activity of recognizing the we-ness, the commonality, the community of panic that was suddenly arising, and two, from the place of responsibility for the crowd to turn around and calm the panic. What an amazing gift. So many people were cooperating in that. And it could have gone otherwise. It could have been otherwise. You know, that could have been another route that it went, but it didn't. It's an amazing thing. It's a subtle difference, as Dogen says in the Fukken Sasenki, if there's a hair's breadth deviation. And we think of the bombers who probably thought in their heads that they were doing something for the benefit of all beings. Somewhere in their hearts, this was a good thing to do, but there was a hair's breadth deviation, maybe even a bigger one than that, in that they forgot about the tender interconnection of all beings. They couldn't empathize with the people who were harmed by the bomb. They had a bigger vision, perhaps, and I've known people like this, people who were devoted to a cause, and I remember when I was younger, you know, in the 60s and 70s, people who fought hard against the Vietnam War in a very aggressive way. It was kind of amazing in a way. I mean, maybe I was one of them. I can't quite remember. But, you know, marching and yelling and thinking we were right and the stupid people in Washington were wrong. And, you know, this great, great division in our hearts. And I remember the first time I heard Thich Nhat Hanh, who was Vietnamese himself, and he had gone to the Paris peace talks, and I heard about this monk who was saying this really weird thing that we shouldn't separate from the people who are causing so much harm. We should hold even the pirates on the ocean around Vietnam in our hearts, that we shouldn't make a separation, that we should see through their eyes. Whoa, that seems outrageous to me. And certainly at the time, I couldn't believe it because, you know, the people in Washington were wrong and I was right. And the people who were fighting in the war were wrong, and the people who were protesting the war were right. It's a very rare thing to practice so much with such great sincerity over really long periods of time that we begin to get a glimpse of the subtle and not so subtle ways that we protect the integrity of our little self, the little self that knows we're right and that everybody else is wrong. So when we offer criticism to another person, when we know in all of our senses that other person is just screwing up, we can maybe pause for a moment and remember that their screwing up is our screwing up, that we are not separate, that there is a way to offer direction with kindness that is contingent upon and based upon the recollection of our complete interconnection, our complete co-arising. This is quite a direction from our ancestors in the way. It's really hard to do it. It's not the habit that we formed over many, many years. I know for myself, I remember as a child feeling like I was really greatly loved by my parents and my older brother, and everybody always was very encouraging to me. And when I went to school, I couldn't believe that people were not encouraging to me anymore. In a way, my parents and my older brother did me a disservice by indulging me in a way, although it was kind of a nice thing at the time. I really remember being puzzled about why everybody didn't just love everybody I wonder if all five-year-olds feel that when they go to kindergarten or whatever age it is when we go into the public, into school. And this just got worse and worse and worse as school went on. All of the assaults, all of the unkind correction that just accumulates. We all have it. We all are so tenderly ready to defend ourselves against the onslaught of unloving words. So how important it is for all of us to keep practicing this. Dogen must have known that. He wrote this for his lay practitioners, but of course his own monks would have heard it as well. This is a universal recommendation, as the translation is for Fuken Sasengi. Every one of us has to keep remembering that there's no separation. And so this lovely line embedded right in the middle of this text: beneficial action is an act of oneness. Just one more thing, because I knew I would be giving the talk today, I was kind of on the alert for beneficial action. And I wondered where I would see it. And of course, you know, when you're on the alert for that sort of thing, you see it everywhere. But there was one moment this morning in Dokusan that really dissolved me, when someone got up and bowed and then opened the door in a way that there was no separation between the touching the doorknob and the opening of the door. I don't know how I knew this, but it just went right through me like a lightning bolt. This person, I'm pretty sure, wasn't thinking, I am now going to open the door as an act of beneficial action. But it was beneficial action. No thought, just simply being with it. So we can't force this kind of thing to happen. We can't force oneness. This is not an idea. But if we really look deeply into the feeling of separation, and we really see how natural it is, and we stop fighting it, beneficial action, kind speech, and generosity naturally arise. Beneficial action is an act of oneness, benefiting self and others together. Thank you. So, because it's just us, we all know what to do. But let's say our names anyway. I'm Melissa.
I'm Steve.
I'm Frank.
Matt.
Diane.
David.
It occurred to me a few days ago that wouldn't it be nice if our brains actually worked the opposite way? Instead of, you know, the self being the dominant, you know, factor, it was instead that, you know, it was hard for us to, you know, pull up the self, you know, had to really work at that. Maybe we wouldn't be able to drive or read.
But I know what you mean. There's a kind of ruefulness that I feel when my little self takes over. You know, and the little self is part of the big self again. We don't want to separate, you know, I love what you're saying. I just wish it was different too.
And then, of course, I went on, babies, you know, babies are like that. And I thought, maybe primitive cultures, that's what they're like. You know, we could just flip it.
I'm recalling Joanna Macy, and I think other people also talk about that the innocence or the directness we're heading to is not the same as babies. Because babies are actually don't get let a lot of information in and don't have a lot of capacity, and that there is something about the separating and then coming back, because certainly there's a quality, you know, in babies and all around us that we want. But
we think
We think we want.
Right. But there is something about this universe that actually separates.
Mm-hmm.
That why did stuff occur? I mean, mm-hmm. everything mm-hmm. blew up, and that's the start of the great mm-hmm. story.
Mm-hmm.
And that part of the story is this longing for the oneness. Like, oh yeah,
mm-hmm.
we remember that.
Mm-hmm. And it was so beautiful, you know, because my mind has gone to the, you know, people from the marathon. So, you know, it's just so touching to think about helping each other, which is what happens when there are disasters like this. You know, it is our deepest impulse, I think, you know, unreflective, just impulse when we see another being in pain.
Whenever there's one of these tragedies, the first place my heart goes to is the person who caused it. And I feel such enormous sympathy for the incredible pain they have to be in to do that. And I realize, I think, it's because I have a child who I love deeply, who I can imagine is capable of having done those things. So it, Ben has given me a sense of connection to the people who do the bad things that normally we would feel so disconnected. Third of the mentally ill population in this country is in prison. Not receiving the services they need.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine that at this point in your life, because of all the work you've done, you can see the gift that Ben has to you.
It just incredible.
Yeah.
Just. I mean, I've known that for a long time.
Yeah.
I mean, he's been such an agent of transformation for me.
But the natural tendency, not everyone gets a gift like this, and natural tendency is to push away that sort of behavior, that sort of incapacity to have empathy, and, you know, as you say, incarcerate them. Send them away, not thinking about them. And this is the same teaching, you know, to how do we open? How do we open our hearts to everyone? Is there every, you know, I remember somebody once saying to me, I made the statement, everybody's doing their best, and somebody said, that's not true.
Yeah.
A person I thought was a teacher, that's not true. You're not always doing your best. And, you know, I knew what he meant, that people do terrible things. But, you know, we, from our limited view, I think people are always thinking, this is the best thing to do. Until, like, sometimes a millisecond after. and then we go, a lot of us go, thank you.
Well, and then from this place of oneness, then, and of realizing everyone is us, there then also is how do we protect everyone? So protect people who can cause damage. How do we protect them from the pain or the acting out and the repercussions, and so it's not a bifurcated bad good, but you know, relatively, we do need to act skillfully. So wonderful and so important, and what we always forget is this oneness. But also, assuming the oneness, how do we take skillful action? I was thinking, so the image of Aikido, so when someone attacks you, you're trying to both protect the attacker and yourself. So to protect the attacker from causing harm, which will cause more harm, then they become embedded in that. So to deal, but it's also not to stand there and let someone hurt you. So that some new way of acting that is effective, honoring that we always talk about the relative and the absolute. So if we say everything is just one, you know, that's true, and horribly wrong to set off a bomb, to intentionally hurt other people. It's not okay on some level. And then we want to split and say, well, I would never do it, and evil. So how to walk the middle way?
Well, to address the pain before it becomes expressed in a harmful way.
Yeah.
For me, then we get back to, it's not possible, you know, that the world, for me, the world is on fire, and in this lifetime, that is the reality of our existence, and so...
But it is possible to do what we can, and I think that is such an imperative, that we make the difference we can, and...
Well, and just to point out that both these views are true.
So
but, you know, we want to also be careful to let ourselves have our strong feelings about this and not have to have it be an opposition to this. It's true that the world is on fire, and it's true that you do what you can. And, you know, and each one of us has our own way of negotiating that internally, because it's so painful. When we sit, just to really feel the division. At least it is for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it's the bird and the drop of water.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And then beneficial action is actually aligning with that deepest yearning of what we see in the world and what we are called to do. And, you know, this interesting that it's action we're talking about, you know, not just contemplation. How do we align with that great desire to be of service, seeing that we're being of service to ourselves, this world that is us?
So I think there's a great trap of getting caught up in ideas of destination, you know, I often think, you know, well, here, you know, so Buddhism has been around for, you know, what, 2600 years or something, and the world was on fire then, and it's on fire now, you know, so what has Buddhism accomplished in these 2600 years, you know? I mean, why isn't the world a better place than it is? You know, if Buddhism is so great, you know, why hasn't it solved the problems of the world by now? You know, and I think this. I love that you pointed out that this separation, you know, is a part of being human, and that, you know, as David said, the universe had to explode in order for us to be here. And, you know, it's not about getting it to all go back together and be lovely and sweet and nice once and for all. You know, it's this life which is both separation and union and and it's a never-ending struggle. We don't need it to end it to be headed towards this this final resolution. And I get so I get so caught up in, well, so you can do that on a personal level too, and say, well, why haven't I attained true enlightenment here? I mean, I shouldn't, if I were really benefiting from these teachings, I shouldn't, continue to keep going through this cycle, of up and down and gain and loss and understanding and not understanding. And I do, and I go, well, what is going on here? as you pointed out, so this is our life, and separation. And to try and honor that in myself is so hard, to honor that those feelings of separation and not feel like, oh my God, so now I found the problem is this feeling of separation. I need to push this away and then, I'll be united and everything will be wonderful, and it doesn't work. You can't just not be separate, Being human is to be separate and to be able to sit with the separation and the bad feelings of, that come up around the separation is that's our practice, our never-ending bodhisattva practice.
I really bow to you for what you just said. I think it's so important to find words to speak that, and I found it helpful to hear it. Because it is very easy to, I can't remember what you said at the very beginning, but it was really like right on that some...
To get caught up in the goal of perfection.
Yeah, just we have this idea like, so we think we know what nirvana is. Mm-hmm. And we think we know what enlightenment is. Or peace, I know I can envision a world where nobody will ever bomb people again. Everything will be fine. And so if we keep moving towards that, we're not gonna feel the great aliveness of life, which manifests as division,
right,
and as connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I think for me, if I have a goal, it's to recognize aliveness in myself and in other people, and see how much I want it to be different, whatever it is, right? And then cherish that as well, like that wanting things to be different. So the Buddha didn't teach, or at least my understanding of what the Buddha taught, is if you do this meditation practice, you will be fine. I never heard that. I mean, you can kind of manipulate his teachings to aim in that direction, selectively pluck out pieces. But the main thing is, the world is on fire. And so what are you going to do?
And what comes to my mind around this is this feeling of pulsing, this alternating, that is... fills the universe. I mean, maybe even the vibration of the smallest thing. And somewhere Dogen talks about life turning on and off, like 70,000 times per second. So every second there's this flashing, and it's not constant, but we put it together as constant. But in actuality, it's coming into existence and fading away every instant. And I think of that. And of course, our awareness, comes together and it's clear, and then splits apart. Right, and that's the dance.
Because there's really no life without that dance. I mean, that's, you know, you can all, you can look at it like, well, that's why we're alive, you know, because without that, you know, what is there? There's just this cool nothing, you know, it's just bright nothingness, you know. Yeah. And I wanted to live, you know, I wanted to play, And this separation is part of that, and it has consequences, you know, separation has consequences. Right. If you want to play, you gotta, you know, you gotta.
Yeah.
And I mean, going back to your original point that the world is not any better than it was 2,500 years ago, I think there are a lot of measures by which the world is a better place. You know, infant mortality, you know, people die from hunger. The amount of conflict in the world is lower than it has ever been before. We're much more aware of it because of, you know, our global connections. But in a lot of ways, you know, the world is becoming a better place. And there are social scientists who study levels of consciousness, so levels of development, like for a child going from very egocentric to more, you know, ethnocentric to more world-centric to cosmocentric. And the percentage of the population at each level of development is moving up. So that, you know, I think it is making a difference. It's, you know, we are as a, you know, our sort of collective consciousness is expanding. And I see that as a hopeful thing. I see that as something that may help us save the world from destroying itself.
And so as you're talking, I heard that there was a book that was talking about this, about really looking at violence in the world, and it's really diminished. And of course, then I read another study of someone critiquing the book and saying, well, he took this and he didn't take this into account. And so just realizing there are all these different stories we can tell. And that there is truth in so many different stories, and what do I want to say? That whatever, actually, that's it. So that whatever, I certainly hope it's going in that direction. And sometimes I see those signs too, and I'm incredibly inspired. Other times I don't think it's going in that direction. And it seems like, you know, we're about to destroy this whole planet we're on, and the time has run out. But whichever story, actually, I go to, well, I don't know. And it doesn't make any difference in terms of how I behave.
Yeah. Right.
So that my work is still right here. What am I called to do? How can I do this?
But I guess the way it does make a difference is, well, maybe it doesn't, is not throwing up your hands saying, you know, what difference does it make if I do anything? You know, nothing's going to change. I think things do change.
So, you know, I go back to the work of Joanna Macy, who the danger with that book and the view that everything's getting better is to not see the immediate suffering. And she was very clear about feeling the despair and letting that transform itself, not through some idea that everything's going to be okay if I do this, but this, whoa, oh my God, oh, the world is on fire. So I have to be that little bird who's flying around. Because it's true, there's that one book that says everything's getting better, and then there's all the other studies that contradict it, and blah, 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 blah. And I always remember this wonderful text that I read years ago. I can't remember the name of the writer. He's a science writer who died of cancer. He used to write columns, and he was diagnosed, when he was diagnosed with cancer, he was told by his doctor that he had a 10% chance of surviving. And he said, being a scientist, he said to the doctor, "How do you know this? That I personally have a 10% chance of surviving?" And the doctor said, "Well, that's what the statistics say." So he decided to investigate the statistics and saw that indeed, everyone who had been diagnosed with this form of cancer, 90% of them died within, you know, a year, and the other 10% lived longer. And then what the article was about was that made absolutely no difference to him. And I think, you know, that the person, say one individual who lost his legs at the marathon, it doesn't matter that everything's getting better or that everything's getting worse. It's like, you know, this complete, every single one of us is a unique individual. And, you know, the sun is going to go nova eventually, and it won't make any difference, you know. So we can't, I don't want to encourage any of us to think just globally, but also to remember the individual and to sort of bring them all together. Each one of us is on our own trajectory, and as David said, ultimately, it doesn't make any difference who's right and who's wrong, because we'll never know. We're going to suffer and die. And So in this moment, even the suffering and dying is another theory. Suffering and dying, everything getting better, people are kinder, people are meaner. They're piles of statistics. This moment is what counts. This is it.
I think of the song of the grass roof hermitage, perishable or not, the original. So will this person perish or not? And the answer to that is, well, perishable or not, the original master is here. I think that's what you're saying.
Right.
Plus or minus. Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that if things are going in a good direction or in a bad direction, Buddhism doesn't have anything to do with it. You can also point to lots of ways that Buddhism has been really destructive.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, wars caused by Buddhism, just like Christianity. And, you know, over and over again, just this, just this. So, thank you all.
Thank you.